And I believe that God has a huge plan for this generation that we have and the generation that's just coming up. I think revival is going to come through them.
Hey everybody, Doc Brian here, and welcome to Doc Talks. We talk about people's troubles, trials, tribulations, and hopefully triumphs in life. Today we're in LifeWord Studios in Conway, Arkansas, broadcasting in over 161 languages to 127 countries to a potential listening audience of 2 billion people. You can find this podcast and all of our other Christian content at lifeword.org. That's lifeword.org. Today I have a guest with me, Michael. It's good to have you with us here. This is our first time meeting.
Yes.
And so glad that you could make it here with us.
Thank you so much. I'm honored. I'm excited and glad to be here.
Yeah. So you're a student pastor right now. That is probably one job you couldn't pay me to do. You know, I have a 10-year-old and he just runs me ragged.
Yeah.
So what is life like as a student pastor?
So as a student pastor, as a family man, it's chaotic, because you're always trying to go to your game, your kids' games and the games of all the people there. And it feels like when everybody else at church has nothing going on, I do. You know, we do a Wednesday night, we do a Sunday night, we do that. I'm trying to meet people throughout the week, and it gets pretty chaotic, but it's also exciting. That just seeing what God is doing in their lives and seeing the hunger of this generation. That's one of the things that I think so many people underestimate this generation, and I believe that God has a huge plan for this generation that we have and the generation that's just coming up. I think revival is going to come through them.
Yeah. There is a sense of authenticity that is being sought from the younger people in this generation today. And I often wonder where that came about, but then I kind of reflect on maybe it was just all the fake stuff that they are exposed to, you know, life on Facebook or Instagram that we know is fake.
Yeah.
And so they're looking for the truth in all of that.
I love that. And like, I've seen studies that have talked about, like, so my generation, like, we don't trust it unless it's highly produced. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because of TikTok, maybe it's because of social media, but the higher production level of a video source to these younger generations, the less they trust it. They want that real, they want that raw, they want that looks like it's been recorded on an iPhone, you know. Mm-hmm. Kind of feel.
Yeah, we've noticed and even talked to staff here at LifeWord that the most views that they get is somebody who's sitting in a car recording themselves on an iPhone and not in the studio somewhere. And so, yeah, I could see how even in my own TikTok and Instagram and stuff like that, I do find that the lower quality gets the more views.
Yeah.
So, Michael, you had kind of an unconventional way of coming to Christ and yes. into ministry. So share that with us.
So I was raised, I guess I'll go ahead and say, I was raised in the Mormon church my entire life. I was born in the Mormon church, went there, kind of fell out a little bit when I was about 17, 18. And then when I was 21, I tried to go back to God, which was the only God I knew, which was through the Mormon church. I actually got married in the Mormon church and everything was good, I thought, until it wasn't. When I was 25 years old, literally my life just came crashing down. My wife wanted a divorce. I didn't understand what was going on because, you know, I don't want to just bash, but the Mormon church, they're very works-based. They don't say they're works-based, but they're very works-based. And it's almost this expectation of if you do this, this, and this, and this, and this, you're supposed to have this, this, and this. I'm like, I'm doing all of these things, but I don't have these things. I didn't understand it. And it was in that place there that I was in the lowest part of my life. That God actually through a pastor at New Life Church really had an impact, was able to speak into me. You know, I tell people all the time, it's like I was in my hole, and finally all the pride, all the everything, all the self-reliance had been stripped down, and God was like, okay, now I can do something with it. And it was through that, I was 25 years old when I came to know the Lord. And I think, you know, in the Mormon church, you know about Jesus, but I didn't know Jesus. Mm-hmm. And it was at that time I had an interaction with guy named Jerry Bridges, and man, we had some conversations, and the short version It was that point where I started to realize that I needed a savior, and I started to realize everywhere that I messed up, and not just in the situation I was in, but just in life. Like, I was really, for the first time, I understood the principle of, like, I sinned and needed a savior. And I asked him, I said, how do you know when God forgives you? I'll never forget the look on his face. He gave me this look on his face, like, what a stupid question. And he said, as soon as you ask, and like, as soon as he said that, it's like, something broke in me. Man, I started ugly crying. It wasn't pretty. And like, my life changed that day. But with through that, I felt like I was coming to God in this place of brokenness. I say some of the times that I was just so excited to have an invite to the party, but I never thought I would have a seat at the table.
Mm. So. Yeah, and I think there's probably a lot of people that still feel that way. Even Christians who are in churches just kind of feel like they're just there. They're just floating along. How did, this is kind of an odd question, but through the divorce, I'm sure that your mental health declined.
Oh, yeah.
But what? How did that change at the point of accepting Christ as your Savior?
That's a great question. So definitely, you know, declined a whole lot. Like I said, I was in the deepest, darkest place. In fact, I was probably, well, not probably, I was, I don't know if you'd say suicidal, because I didn't necessarily had a plan. It was like, I used to tell people, there's no getting over this, there's only getting through this. Like, I was wanting this marriage, I was wanting to fight for it, and if it didn't, I was perfectly okay. I was checking out. I was done. So, but through that point there, man, there was hope in my life, and hope that I don't think I ever really knew before. I started to experience joy, and I started to, you know, it's funny, you know, the book of Philippians, I believe Philippians is the book of joy, and Paul wrote that in prison, so it doesn't matter what the circumstances you are going through. I mean, when you start to spend time in the presence of God, you can start to feel this joy, and I didn't know how to explain it. I didn't know what was going on, but all I know, like, those thoughts were gone, and this doesn't mean it wasn't hard, but I definitely wasn't struggling in the same way.
Yeah. So what we would call that is suicidal ideologies, where we don't have a plan. We don't really have say, okay, this is what I would do. This is how I would do. But the thoughts in the back of your head. Of course, if you're listening, you have those thoughts, you need to get help. You need to seek out a pastor or a counselor, or talk to your physician about that. You know, one thing that you said, and I like the way that you said it, was that I had to get through it. And a lot of times people say, well, I'll get over it. Or I'll, you know, David, he said, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. It doesn't say over it, around it, under it. We have to walk through those times. And we know that God is attracted to our brokenness. So in those moments that we just feel the most broken is when we become less, he becomes more. So you mentioned you kind of felt like you were in a prison, which then leads us to your first ministry assignment.
So I got involved in prison ministry and had no intention to get involved in prison ministry. In fact, it was at our church, we do life group launches. And then this time, I think it was even on a Tuesday. I don't think it was a Sunday. Sometimes we do it Sundays. Sometimes we do it Tuesdays. But what it is everybody that's doing a small group gets a table. And they set up a little presentation, and you almost get to, like, it almost looks like a fair. You go around, you get to talk to everybody. Well, I didn't really know anybody at the church, so the first person I went to talked to was a guy named Johnny Tyler. And Johnny Tyler,
Johnny's a great guy.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
He's actually was one of the groomsmen at my wedding.
Okay.
But I went to go talk to Johnny Tyler because I'd been introduced to him, and that was about as far as it got. And he was like, hey, Michael, you should sign up for prison ministry. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. I did my polite thing. Yeah, nodded, shake head, had zero intention. I went to the next table and I talked to the guy. And as soon as I left that table, I couldn't even tell you if they were doing a book, whatever. Like, I couldn't tell you what they were going to talk about, what the plan was. I did this for every single table for that were doing men's ministry. And as soon as I it was like the weirdest thing. I could not even remember the guy's name. I could not remember what they were talking about, what the theme was. All I could think of was that stupid prison ministry table. And I went, so finally at the end of it, I went back. I was like, okay, I'm going to sign up. And honestly, it was such a freeing thing for me, which is really weird when you think about it, when I say how freeing prison ministry was. But I was coming from this place of brokenness. I was coming from this place thinking that God didn't have purpose for me anymore. And when I got into prison ministry and I started talking to these guys, it was very clear and very evident that God still had plan and still had purpose for him. Mm-hmm. And it's like God was telling me that, look, you know, I'm not done with them and I'm not done with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tell people a lot of times, if you're still breathing, God still has a purpose and a plan for you. Mm-hmm. The minute that that's over, you'll be out of here. but you know, sometimes, with prison ministry, you have a captive audience. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like they can just go and drive home.
Yeah.
What was that first time that you went into the prison for this ministry? What was that like for you?
Terrifying. I'll never forget the first time the leader there, you know, so Johnny Tyler was one of the guys that there, but the guy that actually led it, his name was John Newberry. Mm-hmm. And he walked through, and the very first time you walk through the metal detectors and he spreads his arms and legs for the pat down, I'm like, oh, this is happening. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was just going to try and take it all in. The way we did prison ministry there is we did a service and we always left time at the end for them to pray with us. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't very comfortable praying in front of people. That's something, it's funny that like now I'm a pastor and now I'm praying with people all the time. But from that age, like praying in front of people, I didn't want any of it. Mm-hmm. That these people have felt like had such eloquent prayers, and they got all the words and this and the these and the thous, because you know, in the Mormon Church they use King James only version of it, and I always felt so inadequate with it. So when he was telling me, he's like, Michael, we're gonna pray at the end. He's like, but you don't have to pray. You can just sit there. I'm like, that's good, because that's what I'm gonna do. Like, I'm not getting up there. And at the end, the worship that they had there. And at the end, he invited us all up to pray. And I'm like, I'm not going to get up. But I felt myself like standing up. And I'm like arguing with my body. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, we already decided. And I got up there. And then all of a sudden, there was a line of like three or four inmates just to get right in front of me to pray with me. And just hearing these stories, hearing what they're going through, hearing what they went through, hearing like, and just getting to pray with them. And I didn't know what words to say, but I mean, like, I really felt like, you know, Holy Spirit definitely gave me words at that time. But I think that was when, like I said, that realization happened about how God still has purpose for these. And my heart was breaking for these guys. And I don't know, that was my first real exposure with ministry.
Yeah.
And I think it just changed something in me.
What kind of gravity a situation do you feel when you realize that you're praying to the creator of the universe for these people who are in prison?
You know, at the time, I don't think I really thought about it. But I mean, I think that there's just, man, there's power. But really, I think there's power in any time you're praying for somebody else. Though anytime you're putting somebody in front of your needs, you know, we always teach people that, you know, one of the best ways to handle offense is by praying the things that you would pray for them over other people. Well, that's a powerful tool just in general. When you start praying the things you want for yourself, for people, not just out of offense or people that you're offended by or people, but when you start really seeing those people, I think that's when you start adopting the heart of God and seeing them the way that God intended you to see them.
Yeah. I mean, if you boil down Psychology 101, if you want more of something, you give that away. You know, if you want more love, you got to give love away.
Mm-hmm.
Dale Carnegie once said, in order to have friends, you must be friendly. And I think that's in the Bible somewhere that he copied that from. Of course, he gets a lot of credit for that.
Yeah.
So you went from one prison ministry to another as a student pastor.
Yes.
So what was that like coming out of prison ministry? Just being thrown into that.
Well, I felt the call started to feel a call to get involved with student ministry, and really I didn't see myself leading or anything. I just felt like I needed to get involved, and ultimately it was because the number one thing I heard these inmates say was, "If I only knew then what I know now," mm-hmm. or some variation of that. So when I actually started getting involved in student ministry, I actually thought of it as an extension of prison ministry. I thought it was like prison ministry. And it's funny, like, I felt kind of called to get involved. I started serving with our high school and didn't really know what was going to go there. And I kind of had this surrendered moment because at the same time I was doing sales and I really felt like I needed to do a career shift. I took a major pay deduction to go from selling software, IT servers, all that stuff like that, to being a teacher. So I went and I got my master's in teaching. And I was doing as a high school teacher for a while. Well, I say high school, but it was all happening at the same time. I kind of had this conversation with God. I was like, all right, God, I'm going to do this, but I'm not working with middle schoolers. and like
first mistake.
Yeah. Within a month, I didn't think I was going to get to teach that year, but a teaching position opened up at a school in Jacksonville last minute. I knew a guy who was like, are you still looking for a teacher job? I'm like, yeah, but there's not time. He's like, call this number, call it now. And then within like the same week, my pastor, James Kamani, asked to meet with my wife, Kelly, and I, and asked us to be the middle school pastors. Mm-hmm. So, and the teaching job was for 7th and 8th grade math. Mm-hmm. So it's like I surrendered on this condition, and God's like, I'm going to show you what I'm going to do with your condition.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Isn't that crazy how God works those things out. Yeah. I remember when my wife and I, we came to fill in. I'm pastor at North Little Rock, and we came to fill in one Sunday. We got in the little Malibu, headed home. And I said, I'll never pastor a church in North Little Rock. And 2 weeks later, I was voted unanimously as the pastor at North Little Rock. And then I said, well, I guess we're moving to North Little Rock. So it's funny how God shows up and interrupts everything. And I truly believe that God is in the interruptions mm-hmm. of life. So switching kind of gears here to a mental health aspect, mm-hmm. what do you see amongst middle schoolers? What age group is that? Like where are we looking?
So for me, when we started middle school, it was 5th through 7th grade, but now ours is 6th through 8th grade. So that's going to be around the ages of like 12, 13, and 14.
Okay. So within that age group, what do you see is probably the most prevalent mental health issue?
So probably the most prevalent, and I'd say the most widespread, but not often the most talked about, is anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. You know, the big ones, the suicidal, the extreme depression, and the LGBT influence, transgenderism, like all of that, you know, that's something that I think gets a lot of focus, and it's there, it's very prevalent, but the majority of them, in fact, I would say the large majority of them probably are experiencing some kind of anxious or depressive thoughts mm-hmm. at any given week.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. The number one diagnosed mental health condition in the United States is anxiety, but it's also the number one easiest to treat. And, you know, I've talked with some people about, you know, 1 Peter 5:7 says, be anxious in nothing. Mm-hmm. And how even that can make somebody anxious. Mm-hmm. We know context is key, and mm-hmm. it's not talking about traditional anxiety as we see it. But what do you see as kind of the, well, let me ask this question first. Do you see more anxiety in boys or girls?
I think I see the traditional forms more in girls, but I think I think that it looks different in boys. Mm-hmm. And I think what maybe even on this, the ADHD and stuff like the hyperactivity and stuff like that, my personal, and I could be wrong on this, you're the professional, but I think a lot of that maybe stems from some anxious thoughts and different things that you're just not sure what to do, and you're fidgety. And so,
most mental health conditions come from some type of trauma, mm-hmm. whether it's a known trauma or not, it comes to the forefront of things. And, you know, I think it's normal and I think it's healthy to worry about things, to be concerned about things, but I define anxiety as when worry becomes a physical manifestation. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that fidgeting, that anxiousness that sometimes mm-hmm. we pigeonhole into being ADHD isn't always ADHD.
Yeah. Well, you talked about that verse, 1 Peter 5:7, and I love that verse, But, you know, just like with all, you know, you talk about context, but also language really matters as well. You yeah. know, the word that's translated, I forget the word, I'd have to look it up, that we just translate simply as yeah. be, mm-hmm. is more than just like when we think what, just don't be anxious. No, it's more of don't remain in a state of anxiety is one way to put that verse. Mm-hmm. It's a much more a permanent state when it says the word be. Mm-hmm. So it's not saying you can't have anxious thoughts. Mm-hmm. It's saying don't stay there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of my most quoted lines is, however you feel, it's okay to feel that way because God made you to have these feelings.
Yes.
But don't unpack and live there.
Yes.
And a lot of times we get comfortable in that setting and we, you know, it's a lot like people who have a bipolar diagnosis. They get off their medicine because they don't feel comfortable in normal, mm-hmm. you know, in that baseline of normal.
Makes sense.
So in middle school ministry, what has been the most, I don't want to say the most shocking, but maybe the most concerning mental health issues that you have seen in your experience?
The most concerning, I definitely would have to say the amount of middle schoolers who have talked about or even attempted to take their own life. Mm-hmm. It's something that is becoming, I don't want to say like a badge of honor, mm-hmm. but it's almost like especially in some circles, it's like the more trauma you have, the more prestigious you are in this yeah. group. And it's almost like they end up, they not just magnify it, but they almost end up like seeking the trauma that's not even theirs mm-hmm. to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we try to tell people your story is your story. You don't tell other people's stories. This is yours. Mm-hmm. We do kind of live in a one-up society,
yes.
Which is even more prevalent within that age group. So as a pastor, what do you do when you have someone who you feel may be suffering from a extreme depression or even getting into some suicidal ideologies?
So I will say one thing, especially with my wife in her field, you know, me and her have spent a lot of time talking about this, understanding what needs to be reported. Mm-hmm. So we do mandated reporter training at our church. Maybe less formal than I think maybe we need to, and we've talked about doing, but we sit down with everybody that's going to be serving and say, hey, this is the things we need to look for. These are reportable things, et cetera. But for me, like, it's a lot of also, like, I try to look at this as a pastor. You know, I look at this a lot from a spiritual mindset. And I will say, for me, one of the things I've really been challenged in and stretched in is when you see a lot of these mental illnesses and a lot of these depressions and the anxieties, know, is this a spiritual, is this a physiological, or is this an environmental thing? And it's not like it's just going to fit neatly into one category or the other. I grew up, my dad was military. I grew up almost you handle your own stuff. You know, don't tell anybody about it. Even, you know, with my dad, you know, they would, visiting a therapist, a counselor, would you go on your record and you could actually hurt you even with promotion.
Right.
Like, so,
right.
you, so you're...
Sure.
So I grew up with that almost like, you know, you just got to take care of yourself. You yeah. pull yourself up by your bootstraps, mm-hmm. Which is really funny because I'm married to a therapist.
Skip-free therapy. And it doesn't go on your record.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But with that, I've really been able to expand and see the need for it. But for me personally, I guess to answer the question, I do try to take more of the environmental and the spiritual thing, mm-hmm. understanding how spiritual warfare is done. You know, I'm big on talking about Ephesians 6, putting on the armor of God, breaking down what each of that means practically, mm-hmm. and hoping to change some of their habits mm-hmm. by getting them to invest more time into life-giving habits than what they are. I find a lot of the kids, I think a lot of this anxiety and a lot of the depression and stuff they have is because, I mean, I want to just blame screen time. Mm-hmm. Although the research out there points a lot towards it, but I think that's almost a secondary issue. It's not necessarily that, oh, you have something on your screen in your hand at all time. It's that your focus is on things that are not life-giving versus focus on the Word of God, focus on time serving versus time growing, growing yourself and growing others.
Yeah. Yeah, there was just a psychological study that was produced that said now there isn't just anecdotal evidence, but there is correlation and causation between the amount of time that a child spends on social media and their mental health. Mm-hmm. I think as therapists, we've always known that. We just haven't had that study. But I would say it would even expand into the adults, you know, the more time that they are isolated, because that's exactly what it is. You're isolated. And then you see, because you only see the good stuff, you know, people's good lives.
Your highlight reels.
Yeah, they, you don't see what's actually going on in their life. Mm-hmm. And then you begin to compare, and we know comparison's the thief of joy.
Yeah.
And so before you know it, maybe environmentally we have slipped into this depression that because we've been in it so long now, we've slipped into a mental health condition. Mm-hmm. So as a pastor with a wife who's a therapist, how do you tell when it slips from an environmental or spiritual thing into a mental health issue?
That is a great question.
There's no wrong answers here, by the way.
There's no wrong. That's good, because I don't really have the right answer for it. What I will say is I am very, very quick to recommend going to a therapist. Me personally, I don't always like the throw pills at mentality that I think that some of our some therapists in the field go to. But I also recognize that medication is a valuable tool, and some people need it, and some people need it for long term, and some people need it for short term.
Sure.
I think that I think the ultimate thing is to try to get them with a trained professional that can help them. You said something earlier about the trauma in our life, and I think that a lot of that really needs to be, like, that's a lot of what it comes down is finding some place that they can get that addressed. Mm-hmm. I've learned, and I don't want to bash therapists, but I've seen, you know, there's a lot of good therapists out there and there's a lot of bad therapists out there. And some of them do, I think, what some people call talk therapy, which is, what are we talking about today? And there's no progression. There's no digging. There's no anything like that. So finding someone who can actually address some of these root issues is key. Because I think that, you know, the body keeps the score, you know, there's memory, like even down to the same, you know, a lot of the things that they're dealing with, I think, are affected to things in the past.
Yeah. So I'm not a medical doctor, so I'm not supposed to have an opinion about medicine. But I will say this, that's my disclaimer. There are mental health conditions such as bipolar, schizoaffective disorder that have to be treated by medication. Mm-hmm. Any other disorder outside of that, medication shall, in my opinion, should only be used as an adjunct to get them through therapy.
I like that.
Because therapy in and of itself is traumatic.
Yeah.
You know, just going there. You know, I remember growing up, there was a young man in our youth group that he just went completely out of character and doing things. And I remember him coming back and his parents saying, well, the doctor said he had a chemical imbalance, and we're like, can we get that? Like, you know, is that contagious? How does that work? And so, you know, I think it's very important that we recognize and we're very careful. But then I'm of the mindset, too, that I don't think primary care physicians should be able to prescribe medication for mental health conditions. But that's a whole other bag of worms. You did mention talk therapy, and I think there is a value to talk therapy, but I think that it has to have a plan. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more like, okay, tell me what's going on in your life today, but then out of that we pick out the common or reoccurring issues to address those.
That makes sense.
Those issues. Within that, you said you're very quick to recommend a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
How is that? Let me back up here. Probably the kids don't have a problem with that, but how do the parents respond to that?
That's another great question. So I think more and more it's becoming widespread. It's becoming more acceptable. I think there's a lot of people, even, you know, because, you know, my age, I'm almost 40 years old. You know, I've got a almost 18-year-old child. So a lot of these parents of these kids are my age that I'm talking to. I think the fact that I'm an older youth pastor, I'm not one of these like 22, 23 year olds. I think the fact that I've got some experience behind me, I think carries a little more weight when I talk to him about it. But I do think our society is shifting a little bit. I think we're moving more and more out of the "you're weak for getting a therapist" kind of mentality. I think seeing, you know, I was at our Russellville campus. I don't know, you know, Caleb Haigley. Mm-hmm. So Caleb Haigley was at one. I was visiting his campus one time, and man, he was just boldly talking about, you know, his time in therapy and how much it meant for him, how powerful it was, and encouraging guys, if you need help, get help. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing people in a position of influence take that stance more and more, and I think it's making that conversation with parents a lot easier.
Yeah, and then on the other hand, we have pastors who are younger than us that make the claim that anxiety and depression are sin. You know, and you and I can laugh about that, but there are people in their congregations that then become suicidal because I've had this all my life. I'm sinning all my life. I don't have the relationship that I thought that I once had. So I think it's important for us as pastors to not make conclusional statements when it comes to something that's such a broad topic.
Yeah. I talk, so one of the best teachings I've heard about anxiety was actually Pastor Craig Rochelle, and he did a message, he did a series on mental health, and he talked about, he equated anxiety to the check engine light on your mm-hmm. car. Yeah. It's like, you know, when you have that, you're feeling those anxious things, it's that check engine light. Mm-hmm. He's like, that means it's time to get your car checked out. He said, that means it's time to pray. He said, now it's a bad thing to drive around mm-hmm. with that check engine light all the time, yeah. You know. But yeah, no, I think it's important to have those conversations, and I try to have those real conversations with these kids about how to handle this, what to do with it. We did a series called Hard Questions, and for 2 months before we got to this series, we had a big box, and we had them drop questions in there. Mm-hmm. And then based on those questions, we did a 4-part series where we tried to answer the questions. And then, and like the majority of them were either about LGBT, whatever, or mental health issues that they were dealing with. And then the small percentage after that was the apologetic styles, like how can a good God let bad things happen?
Right. Yeah. I love the analogy of the check engine light because us young people would seek help. Older people would just take a piece of black tape and cover it on the dashboard and ignore it.
Yeah.
And that kind of is the premise of mental health for them. We just ignore it. So, Michael, wrapping this up, if you had one message for the whole world to hear in relation to ministry and mental health, what would that be?
The best thing you can do for your mental health is to spend time with the one who created you. Time spent in the, you know, even if you look, I mentioned earlier, Ephesians 6, the armor of God, when you talk about it, the breastplate of righteousness, the belt of truth, the boots of peace. Like when we spend time in his presence, and spending time in his presence, I tell my students all the time, we worship with our attention. So not just, hey, I'm reading to check it off, not just I'm singing a song. But like when we actually spend time with his presence, the Bible says we're actually, you know, that God shapes us into his image, and that's when it happens. Yeah. So the more we can spend time letting him shape us, and instead of letting the world shape us, the more and more we're going to find that joy and that peace in the middle of the storms. The storms are still going to come. We're still going to have the hard things. We're still going to deal with loss. We're still going to deal with the grievances. We're still going to have all of this. We're still going to deal with offense. But the way we respond in those, the way we're wired to respond, you know, through the neuroplasticity, you know, the way that our brain just naturally goes, will be shifted and changed to be more of a biblical response instead of a worldly response.
Absolutely. You know what I love about the armor of God is there's no armor on your back.
Mm-mm.
So we're never meant to turn around and go backwards.
Right. Yeah.
Love that. Well, Michael, thank you for being with us here today. Of course, I'm Doc Brian. You can find all of my contact information at thedocbrian.com. Again, we're on LifeWord, and you can find all the content there at lifeword.org. Thank you for being with us here today, and we hope to see you soon. Goodbye.